We'll call the meeting of the Agricultural Rural Development Committee meeting to order April 5th, 2:30 p.m. We have a full schedule today, and members, as you know, we have floor session at 3, so we'll be going till approximately 2:50. We're going to start off with Mr. Vance Haugen, who has a presentation on low-cost milking parlors, which could fit in very nicely to what this committee has done on the Dairy Investment Tax Credit. That should take us till about 10:02. If we do have a little extra time, we may get the mobile out of here quickly. There's been some agreed-to language from some interested parties on that issue. We do not have a quorum at this time, so we cannot take any official action. But we will start with Mr. Haugen when he's ready, which we'll give you some time there, Mr. Haugen.
Yeah. Should be real shortly.
To get set up there. So, and then we will go to the floor session. I apologize to folks that have driven in from some distance. We will take second, right when we get back from the floor session, which should be very short, we will go into AURI. I'm trying to go by folks that have traveled some distance here. And then we will go with Dr. Bill Hartman on avian flu, and then a report from the Minnesota Ag Educators Leadership Council, or MELC. So I think we've got everyone here that we need. So in a few moments, we'll just pause a little bit here until we get the... we could have our friend Pennis tell us about where TB tests are taken from.
I had mine.
You had yours, okay.
Didn't have the rabies back then.
Okay. Okay. No, she didn't.
Technology is wonderful when it works.
It's a great thing. Mr. Haugen, welcome to the Ag Committee. We have with us Mr. Vance Haugen from Cancer, Minnesota, who is also an extension agent in the great state of Wisconsin, just across the river from Fillmore and Houston counties there. So, if you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, and make your presentation on low-cost parlors.
Thank you. My name is Vance Haugen, and I'm an extension agent from University of Wisconsin and a part-time dairy farmer. My wife would be the full-time dairy farmer. And about a month or so ago, I had a chance to invite Representative Davis over to the farm to take a look at some stuff. And I guess let me back up real quickly. I've got 15 minutes to talk with you folks, and this is some important stuff. Because there's a lot of farmers, both in the state of Wisconsin and in the state of Minnesota, that are facing some tough times. And we have a lot of small farmers. And what do I call small? 250 or less. And a lot of those folks are saying, you know, I can't be competitive. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth. They can be competitive. And what I wanted to show was a method, not the method, but a method that we could have some more competitiveness come in so they could be competitive. And it's something that my wife and I have done. And over the last 12 years, I've worked with 400 dairy farmers across the United States to give them some of this competitiveness. So what's the problem? Well, how many cows can you milk? Well, for those of you who have milked cows, not very many. 25 to 30 for a person normally in a stall barn. And this is what we came to look at. These are some typical barns that you would see around. Now, they're antiquated, they're hard to be in, and they're basically two rows of death. Both death for the cows, death for the operator. And it ruins knees, it ruins hips, it ruins backs. But I talked with the dairy farmers, and I had a good friend. He called me up as an extension agent, and he said, you know, he said, Vance, he said, I'm going to have to quit dairy farming. And I said, well, gosh, Rod, I said, you're a good dairy farmer, you're milking 45 cows, you're doing a great job. Why would you want to quit? You're 50 years old, what else are you going to do? And he said, my knees and my back are shot, and I got to quit. I said, Rod, I said, well, you know, why don't you get a parlor? And Rod says, you dumb son of a bitch, I can't afford a parlor. That's just the way Rod talks. So he had it in his mind. So I said, well, what's a parlor going to cost? He said, well, $250,000. And I said, well, I said, Rod, that's ridiculous. What does a pickup cost? And he said, well, that depends on. Is it four-wheel drive? Is it a diesel in it? And I said, that's exactly right. So to make a long story very short, we worked with Rod. He got a little parlor. Just a teeny tiny little swing six parlor. About six units down the center, 6,000 on this side, 6,000 on this side. Nope. That was 7 years ago. He still built it 45 pounds, but he put $4,300 in that parlor and he's going. Now, we can do that with all kinds of parlors. The parlor that my wife and I have is quite a bit larger, quite a bit more elaborate. You know, maybe we wanted the diesel option. Maybe we wanted the four-wheel drive option. But the point of it is we can do it. The other thing is that there's all kinds of barns like these standing empty throughout our heartland, in Minnesota in particular, that we can do something else with. And they're perfectly good because we can turn this into something like this. And those are actual photos of actual parlors that were put, what we call retrofit, putting them into stall barns. They don't have to be ugly. They don't have to be crude. They don't have to be expensive. What's expensive? I was talking to a dairy farmer this morning. And he says, well, you keep talking about these low-cost parlors. What's low-cost? I said, well, it depends on. Because all a parlor is four posts, four lengths of steel, four gates, and a pit. You take your pipeline from the east wall and your west wall, and you put it over your head. And that's a parlor. So you tell me what that's going to cost. And we can make it look like this. And I know some people say, well, you know, I'll never milk one of those home-built jobs because, you know, they're ugly. You tell me that top parlor looks ugly? That is a beautiful home-built parlor. It just happens I have the gentleman that he and his son built it. Dennis, can you wave? So anyway, the point is it can be done. He's my poster child for low-cost, inexpensive parlors. They've got about $36,000 in this little swing pen parlor with automatic takeoffs. That's low-cost. Now, in the effort of full disclosure, let's talk about this. They already were dairy farming. They already had a barn. They already had a milk house. They already had a pipeline. So they recycled, they reused, they used a lot of stuff. But the technology, the ideas are there that this can be done. And we can do this for any dairy farmer. Now think of it. State of Minnesota, 95% of all the dairy farms are under 200 cows. Okay? You can dispute me and say, well, it's actually only 86%. I don't care. The point is, we got a lot of folks that can benefit. A lot of folks say, well, yes, but they're only going to be in it for another 5 or 10 or 15 years, so who cares? I care. Those are my friends and neighbors. So I want them to take a look at this. So my goal today, in the 15 minutes that I have to chat with you folks, is number one, to let you know that these things exist. Okay? And you might say, well, what difference does that make? I'll tell you what difference it makes. It makes a difference so that when you, as legislators, and as folks with influence, talk with other folks throughout the state, you can say, these sort of things exist. You talk with the Extension Service here in Minnesota, which, by the way, is getting pretty anemic. I think we could use a few more folks out there. But then you have to also talk with the university, I guess. I think they're attached to them somehow. So the point is, though, when you do those things, this is one way that we can focus it. And when you were talking before about investment credits or about revolving dollars for remodeling, for retrofitting, this is important stuff. This could be really revitalizing. The other thing, it's non-controversial. You want to have if you've already got a barn there that's already existing, people are using it, and all of a sudden we drop these parlors in, you don't have two rows of death, but you've got something that you can milk 40, 50, 100, 200 cows, nobody's going to put up a complaint about that. So that's kind of an important thing. So, when we're talking about this, I want to give a personal example. This is what our barn looked like when we started 14 years ago, 3 miles out of Canton, Minnesota. It was a single-story barn and it sat empty for 11 years. The farm was sold by FMHA. My wife and I purchased it at auction. We paid the top dollar that day for that farm. But there had not been cows in that barn for 11 years. It was junk. How junky was it? Kind of looked like this.
Mr. Haugen, just a second. We are going to officially call the meeting to order. We do have a quorum. Please continue.
Thank you. This is what it looked like. This is pretty ugly. Pretty butt ugly. But we worked with this. And this is what we milk in today. the little swing 18 parlor. We milk about 100 cows an hour with one person. Generally, it's my wife. She should be here talking, not me. You home milk to take care of the cows.
Working, yeah.
Yeah, she's working. You know, never have more cows than your wife can milk. But I guess my point was that you saw what the thing looked like. It looked like a joke, didn't it? In the years, and this is just to give you an idea of the economic development that we're looking at here. Before we were doing this, our farm was nothing but corn and beans. Nothing wrong with corn and beans. We need corn and beans. But if you're looking at $200 for 200 bushels per acre, $2 corn, that's $400 per acre. Last year, wheat grows a little over $1,500 per acre on the dairy farm. Now, yes, we were a dairy farm. But think about the economic development that's going on here. And we have hundreds of these barns around. So, my goal is to sensitize you, to let you know what's going on out there, so that we know that we can do this. This is important. So if we can get the Extension Service, the university, by the way, their composted bedded pack information that they're doing is wonderful. We in Wisconsin appreciate that. We're using it all the time. But I was going to say that we have a program in Wisconsin that I'm hoping that maybe you might want to emulate over here. And I've been talking with folks on this side of the river. We actually have what we call a rapid response team that goes to various farms after they've had some educational input, and we talk about how this can happen. And it's gotten great, great response. We're in year 4, and so far there's been over 250 farms that have been able to do these retrofits in the state of Wisconsin. The same thing can happen here in Minnesota, and that's why I just want to talk about that as a possibility. So, so that people know what's going on, a little bit background, perhaps a push as you think about things. And I want to leave with two other things very quickly because I see my time is rapidly running out. Just want to take a shot. This is our farm. We happen to rotationally graze. You don't have to. When we milk 100 and some cows, I don't care how you feed your cows, but you can. This is a shot of our buildings. And all of this, all of our 230 acres, actually it's only 200 acres tillable, all the 200 acres is in grass. Okay, big deal. Well, it is a big deal when you think about erosion and some of the other things. And also, when you think about the difference in what the economic potential was for that corn and beans versus what we were taking a look at for animal agriculture. Animal agriculture is extremely important for our state. We want to see more of it in here. And I definitely want to see more in the driftless area. And I don't care what size they are. This is size neutral. I don't care whether it's a 1,000-cow dairy or a 40-cow dairy. Now, maybe a 1,000-cow dairy wouldn't take a look at a retrofit, but they might. The biggest one I've worked with is about 500 cows. That was their option. So, lastly, I want to have another shot of our parlor. Not everything runs smoothly all the time. This cow decided that the brain baby was going to roll the brain stem, and she decided to jump over. You'll notice there is a milker on her. We can get her milk. But she got tired. She's just resting there. And then she was taking some time there. We got the camera. I guess I got only 60 seconds left, so we'll just dispense with the...
No, keep going. We're okay.
Yeah, we're okay.
Mr. Haugen, how did you get that cow off of there?
Hopefully there's not any animal rights folks. I just took a little shot, or a little electric shot to the bump that just jumped right over.
Which way?
Yeah. She's a relatively happy cow. I do have a very small snippet that I want to show you, since we have a little bit of time, of actually milking in one of these parlors. And this is a friend of mine. It's his wife is milking, and it is one of the last parlors that has been built in Crawford County, the county that I have my home base in Wisconsin. And this little parlor was $24,000. And remember now, effort is full disclosure, remember that was $24,000 out of pocket. So they had some stuff to begin with, they reused, et cetera, et cetera. So I know the milking equipment companies jump on me all the time and they say, Haugen, You got to tell everything, and I'll try. I'm trying. But we're going to take a look real quickly here, and I won't. Hopefully the technology will work. And I, oh, I lied. I said 24,000, it's 23,000. Whoops. Hold it. Still nothing. Where's my technology guy when I need him? There we go. People can see this now? Okay. This is what $23,000 will buy you. This is a pretty little parlor. This parlor went inside an existing bar. Leo and Mary Coon, that's Mary Milton there. She's quite a short woman, so it looks like she's way down, but she's actually relatively short. But they were in their mid-50s. The boys were leaving the farm. They had to do something different. Once again, I said the same thing. Maybe you want a parlor. And they, well, I don't think we can afford it. Make a long story short, $23,000 just to have a parlor. Now, the other thing that you got to think about is that they dropped the parlor in the barn. So all of a sudden, you have to have another place to house the cattle. You have to have another way to feed them. Well, we got that all together, too. Their total out-of-pocket dollar to take care of everything, 70 cows, was $55,000. This is the kind of dairy modernization that we're talking about for basically mid-sized farms in this region. It can be done. We can use the existing infrastructure that we have. And so basically you'll see more cows getting milked, but I think that basically, I've basically given you the information that I want to. Unless there's some questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Haugen. We'll go to Representative Blaine and then Erdahl.
Mr. Haugen, I've got a few questions here. Since I'm the only one in this committee or in the legislature that's still milking cows, question number one, are these parlors that you're putting in at these rates, are these used equipment then?
Mr. Haugen?
Most of these are utilizing some used equipment, but for instance, the steel work that you see in there,
mm-hmm.
that was brand new. In other words, that was stuff that was fabricated on site.
Mm-hmm.
We just did the pricing, so a little swing pin would be $900 for the iron, about $2,000 or $3,000 for the fabrication, and then they utilized some of their existing equipment. For instance, in this situation, they had five units already. This is a little swing eight parlor.
Mm-hmm.
So some of it was used equipment, and then they purchased new to bring it up what they needed to have.
Okay. We milk in a double six flat. Are most of the parlors you're putting in pit parlors then?
Yeah, almost all are pit parlors, unless somebody specifically asks. I no longer recommend flat barn parlors. Flat barn parlors are excellent equipment-wise, but they're very tough on
knees,
your hips, your back.
Yep.
Plus a safety issue, there's occasionally a kicking issue. Whereas with these, when you get the cows behind the kick rail, the only way that the cow can get you is she breaks the leg off and beats you with a bloody stump.
Yeah.
So it's a very safe thing.
The most of the parlors that I've seen here now on in your presentation now look like swing parlors.
Right.
So you've gotten away from herringbones and parallels then?
Right. These parlors would all be what we call parabones, which are halfway between a parallel and a herringbone. For those folks who aren't familiar, parallels, cows are parked at a 90-degree angle, and a herringbone is generally at a 40 to 45-degree
yep.
angle, whereas a parabone is a 70-degree angle. But what you have going on is that with our smaller farms, 250 and under, we generally want to work with one milker in the pit, and so what we can do with a swing parlor is that, well, you know, how many arms have you got? Well, hopefully you got two if you're milking, and if I will forgive me if there's anybody milking with one arm, I will acknowledge that. But you can only put one unit at a time. And so if we have a double up, the way that you make a double up, in other words, if you have one unit for each cow on both sides, the way to make those efficient is to have two people in there. Works great for larger throughput. But on these, we're going to be looking at about five cow platforms per hour. And so with one person, this is a little eight, we'd be looking at 40 to 50 cows per hour with one person, full prep, and that's why we take a look at the swing parlors versus the double up. The other thing some people get wild about is the midline versus the low line. With our modern equipment and good vacuum regulation that we have, that's really not an issue, even with some of our used equipment.
So you said, thank you, Mr. Chairman, you said there in this operation that you're seeing here, that we're watching here, they're milking 80 cows, that you said? 70, 80 cows, and how many units then,
Mr. Halgan?
Eight units in there. You'll notice those are stall automatic takeoffs, so they reuse the stuff from the stall barn into the parlor.
For simply.
So that one person is easily able to handle that. Because you've got to remember that pit on eight is only going to be about 17 and a half feet long. So, because on full seams, we're looking at 27 inches per cow to get them in there, and that would mean that you'd have, what, six steps, basically, to handle all those eight units. So it makes it real easy for one operator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Minimum width inside the barn to put in a swing like this. Minimum width.
The absolute minimum is, I kind of hedge my guess, I'll say 17 feet. I generally like to do it in 20. Most of our stall barns are multiples of 30, 32, 34, 36. So we generally have a lot of room to drop these in. And that's another reason why we really recommend the parabones versus the parallels, because we can get them in our existing facilities that we've already paid and appreciated for. And let's face it, those barns are nice looking out there, but they're not nice looking when you're looking at two rows of depth to milk some mornings.
So you can fit, you could fit a swing eight like this in a 34 foot wide existing block barn.
That's done all the time, and we can put it either lengthwise or we can put it sideways if you're going to put a swing eight in.
For simply.
Very good. Thank you.
Representative Erdahl then, and I apologize to you, Mr. Halgan, but we are going to have to go in just a little bit. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Halgan, as I think you are aware, we have an investment tax credit being proposed here in Minnesota. How is it working in Wisconsin?
Mr. Halgan.
We have that similar in Wisconsin, and it is told by me, by the farmers, that it's working well, that they appreciate that. And they're utilizing
it. Representative Erdahl.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Halgan, those might be good words to tell our tax committees here, the Senate and the House. Would you ever be interested in talking to them with this presentation?
I would be more than interested to talk to anybody about this presentation. This is important stuff.
Mr. Representative Erdahl?
Thank you.
Okay. And with that, and again, Mr. Halgan, I thank you so much. I apologize that we've got to get over the House floor. That's not the way it was planned when we set these things up. We had to move it yesterday from noon to 3, so we will be in recess until 10 minutes after session. I probably won't even announce it on the House floor. 10 minutes after session, we'll take the Mo bill up and then go into Ari, Mel C., and Bill Hartman, and Avian Flu. Not necessarily in that order. We are in recess. Okay, we have a lot of very important stuff to talk about today. So we will reconvene the meeting of the House Agriculture and Rural Development Committee. I'm going to bring before us House File 3915 as amended. Representative Moe moves House File, the H3915DE2 amendment. This is, I believe, the agreed upon language. Any questions from members? Hearing none, Representative Moe renews his motion for the H3915D2 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have House File 3915 as amended before us. Any further discussion from anyone in the audience? Any members? I just have a comment, Representative Moe. Thanks. You did a good job on this. You did a lot of work. A lot of work. So with that,
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to ask
Representative Moe.
One thing, I just wanted to clear something up. Really, there was Representative Blaine had some questions yesterday about the need for this. Just to remind people what this is doing, there's a lot of information out there right now. We're essentially asking the Department of Ag, Natural Resources, collect what we have, see what the holes are, come forward, tell us about what additional information we have or we need, and then we can decide what to do with that. So I appreciate the members of the committee's time, and I'm glad we're going to finally vote.
Thank you, Representative Moe. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 3915 is passed on to the Rules Committee. And that should be incorporated in the motion. Thank you very much, Representative Moe. Okay, item next. We're very fortunate today to have with us some very good folks that are on that are employed by AURI. I have the privilege as chairman of the House Ag and Rural Development Committee to be a a member of that board. With that being said, we will go to the report, the item 8 on your agenda, members, from AURI. Then we'll probably look at Mel C, and then we want to have quite a bit of time here. We want to have some time for Dr. Bill Hartman. So welcome to the committee. If you could please identify yourself for the record, and we're going to split about an hour and 10 minutes up three ways.
We'll go quickly.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Davis. I'm Teresa Faith, and I've been the Executive Director of AURI for a whole 4 weeks now. I have with me also Max Norris, the Director of Projects and Technology, to discuss some of the projects and technical aspects of what we do.
Teresa, if I could break in once. Oh, I guess I'm the chairman. I guess I can. We were able to secure, out of the fine work of Mr. Mark Nicely, the committee administrator, we do have room till 6, so we're going to try not to rush people through things, and we will continue. So please continue, Teresa.
I'll try not to take till 6.
That's fine.
AURI, as many of you are aware, AURI was a 501c3 nonprofit founded by the state of Minnesota in 1989. Discussions on what is the mission of AURI, or what exactly do we do? Foster long-term economic benefit through the identification and expansion of markets for new or existing commodities, ingredients, and products. And what that means basically is we don't really go out, we won't go to Mexico and try to sell products in Mexico. What we do is we try to find new uses or expanded uses for what we do in Minnesota today. The development and new uses or value improvements for Minnesota agriculture commodities, again, kind of plays into markets are very important. It's important that we establish new uses and communicate to potential buyers new markets, but also we have to work with the supplier, generate new ideas, and spark economic development. And that's what we do for the uses of new uses or value improvements for Minnesota agriculture. And then one of the newest missions that we have that we've been very fortunate to receive over the past year is the development of ag-based renewable energy opportunities. As many of you are aware, that is a very emerging area. Minnesota is a leader in ethanol, biodiesel, and quite a few other renewable opportunities, and we're proud to be a part of that. Well, how do we do what we do? What types of activities do we do? What happens if you are interested in AURI and you want to be a client? We have several initiatives that we take on. One, proactive value-added initiatives. What these are studies or partnerships that we form with other organizations to bring to Greater Minnesota the future trends or what we see as the future for agriculture or value-added commodities in Greater Minnesota. So we work on them. We identify the emerging opportunities with the potential to impact large number of producers. That's one of the greatest tests we have for projects. How many producers do we impact and how much do we increase the value of the commodity? Another thing that we focus on is scientific technical assistance. And one thing we do is we stress greatly scientific. There are a lot of organizations that provide technical assistance to folks, especially emerging businesses. But what we do is we have the scientists on staff in rural locations to actually provide services to help those emerging businesses in R&D. Coordinated network assistance and project management. What we do there is we can't be the expert on everything, unfortunately, but what we try to do is if we have someone come into our offices or our laboratories and want assistance, we don't try to just give them a piece of that assistance. We try to help them through the entire process. So if we come in and we identify that somebody has an R&D need, but they also have a need for, say, a cash flow analysis or a business plan, we will help them contact the best resource available for that type of service and help them understand and incorporate that piece of the pie into the entire project. So we do try to manage a project from start until the point that it does reach the market and not just provide that scientific services. So our networks are very important. And one thing that I think is very unique about our organization, because we are not specifically tied to an educational entity or an agency or a foundation of some sort, we can provide services or select the best service available. No matter what institution it's available at or no matter who is providing that service, we can go there and pick the best and give that to Greater Minnesota, which I think is extremely unique to our organization. And then, of course, the final component of what we do or how we do it is our communication efforts. You should have in some information packets with you our Ag Innovations newspaper that hits over 16,000 individuals across the state of Minnesota and some outside of the state. We also have a very active website where we store quite a bit of information. You can access anything from how to develop a soy candle to the latest information on biodiesel by accessing our website. It's www.auri.org. But quite a bit of information there on the emerging trends in agriculture. So we do take a concerted effort at communication through Greater Minnesota as well as to the metro area. We have quite a few projects that are interested in using commodities right here in the cities, and we help those individuals to develop those products and increase utilization. AURI facilities, this is one of the most unique things about our organization, is we actually have lab facilities right in Greater Minnesota where the assistance is needed. We have a fats and oils lab that has done quite a bit of research in biodiesel, and that's located in Marshall at Southwest Minnesota State University. We have a USDA-certified meat lab that does quite a bit of work on formulation and new cuts of meat. That's also located in Marshall. We have a co-products utilization lab that's located in Waseca. This is one of the biggest growing areas that we have right now, is what to do about the co-products, not only from biodiesel and ethanol, but a lot of other emerging opportunities in agriculture. No longer do we have waste products. We now have a lot of co-products that are increasing in value, and we take pride in the fact that we are helping, especially in the co-products area. A product development lab in Crookston. This is primarily a test kitchen or development kitchen that does formulations for anything from muffin mixes to the latest nutrition label. So we have quite a bit of information going on in the Crookston lab there. And then we also have a microbiology and fermentation lab located at the Crookston facility, which is University of Minnesota Crookston campus. This is an emerging area. Microbiology has been there for quite a while now. We have just started building the capability for fermentation, and we hope that's going to see quite a bit of activity here in the next few years. AURI plants, who do we help? Primarily, we help farmers and farmer-owned cooperatives. Not only are we helping to increase the value of the commodities, but we are very interested in fostering economic development by helping producers go together and form cooperatives or other forms of cooperatives so that they can take advantage of moving up the value chain. Another set of clients are the small and medium-sized agri-processors. A lot of times they have needs, especially technically, as far as meeting regulations or formulating and developing new products. So we work quite a bit with them to try to make sure that they're latest. They have the latest R&D available, and they have the latest emerging trends. A lot of times, if you look at the small processors, it's difficult for them to keep up on the latest information, to understand the latest regulation, or to conduct the latest R&D. What we help them do is make sure that they're able to compete in the market by helping them bear that burden and getting the information out to them. So we do quite a bit of work in that area. And then, of course, emerging ag-based businesses of any sort. We're interested in helping many, many individuals, anyone from that person, again, that likes to make the soy candle all the way up to the ethanol industry and looking at different areas like gasification, conversion from natural gas to other forms of energy. So we're very proud to do that. Who do we work with? AURI doesn't stand alone in value-added agriculture. We have several partners that we work with to help not only identify those emerging trends, but also partner with us. It can be anything from funding or to new initiatives that we see coming forward in agriculture. One of the most important areas, of course, are the commodity and grower groups. We spend a significant amount of time sitting down and meeting with each of these groups and making sure that we're actually addressing the trends and the considerations that they have. We feel that they provide a wealth of information to us, so we make sure that we're not just deciding what needs to happen in value-added agriculture, but we're actually listening to the people that we're trying to assist. A lot of help with that comes from commodity groups and grower groups. Of course, the farm organizations across the state, both farm organizations, Farm Bureau and Farmers Union, have seats on our board of directors, and they provide quite a bit of input on how we should evolve into the future. State and federal agencies, of course, not only the Minnesota legislature, but we work quite a bit with the Department of Employment and Economic Development, as well as Minnesota Department of Ag, to make sure that we're understanding of regulations or issues that are moving forward and that we help get that information into Greater Minnesota. Of course, university systems across the state, we work with both MinSU and the University of Minnesota primarily to get the latest information out to the hands of the population. And then private and public organizations of all sorts, anywhere from foundations and initiative funds to even engineering firms and feasibility firms that are in private business for themselves. So we have quite the network of partners that can help bring that information to Greater Minnesota. With that information, what I'm going to do is introduce Max Norris. He is the Director of Projects and Technology. He helps our scientists keep on the latest emerging trends, and I will introduce him to discuss what AURI has conducted over the past year.
Welcome to the committee, sir. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Max Norris, Director of Projects and Technologies. Thank you, Teresa, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. You've heard in depth the resources that this organization has, where we apply it and how we apply it. Now, my job is to kind of tell you what we've applied and what some of the results and impacts are. One of the areas that we want to share with you today has to do with the assistance of the staff of AURI. And as you can see there, that we have applied over 17,000 hours of development and technical service during projects during FY05. That's a substantial number of hours with a staff of a bit over 21 folks. We have covered, by record, 218 projects that have received technical assistance. That technical assistance may be in-lab assistance. It may be conversation and networking of folks, moving them into, as Teresa had said earlier, working with maybe some business orientations that need to be done. But we've touched that many projects, and hopefully we've had some positive impacts there. We have also provided cost share. Some of the funding that comes from the legislature and so forth is utilized to purchase some services that we may not be able to run in the laboratories in AURI. And we deal with the cost share assistance program along those lines in working with the clients that we have. The impacts that I want to share with you today, too, touches over the last year over 16,000 producers. And, you know, when you look at it, you might ask yourself, what are these producers? Some of them may be individual. Some of them may be agribusinesses. Some may be co-ops that have been up and running for a number of years. And some may be new co-ops, new LLCs, or other business forms of government, business structure that may be out there. And that's one of the ways that we touch the number and have that opportunity to deal with that number throughout the year. Nearly 500 jobs. Now, these are not our numbers. These are numbers that have been identified by each of the clients that we've worked with over the year that has indicated that they have brought that number of jobs forward. We planned and saw actual investment of over $263 million. Many of you folks, certainly if you run a diesel truck, you probably ran some biodiesel. If you're running a regular gasoline truck, you're either running E85 or you're running E10. You might be running E20 or E30. I don't know what you do on your own. But when it's all said and done, the investments that we see going in place out there with these projects are new ethanol plants, new pieces of equipment that allow people to maybe shave the top off of their gas bills. I think each of us see a gas bill every month, and it continues to go up. The price of decatherms approached $16 at one time per decatherm. It's down a bit now, and we're getting comfortable with $7 and $8 per decatherm. But we typically have been in the $5 range, 5 to 5.5. So from those standpoints there, when we see these type of modifications going on in companies and small operations and even growers, individual growers, making investment of that type, this is where those funds come from. All of this work, and we're really proud of this, that $2.6 million supplemented was leveraged, probably a better word to put it, the funds of AURI that were provided by the legislature. So whatever our number, 1.6 million, we leveraged it to 2.6. So not a bad year. Our priority issues it's not uncommon that we talk about energy. As we said and looked today, the price of crude oil is about $66 a barrel. For the next foreseeable future, we're in the $66 to $75 of crude as the price goes, and God only knows where it will go after that. So the types of projects that we become involved with are energy and co-product utilization. For every time that you provide an energy project out there, biodiesel is a good example. You create a side stream called glycerin. And some of the folks sitting on your committee here in the, that have been in the soybean industry for a number of years fully recognize that inundated in the marketplace with glycerin, it will create a problem. We must find new uses for that. The same way with ethanol. And the growth that is there and is continuing throughout the next few years and probably well into the future, we have to deal with the side streams and the co-products called EDGs. We are also in those commodity areas. We don't forget the rest of them. There's many commodity groups within the state that range from wheat and barley. We have programs in those areas, and we do provide attention, and we provide attention along the food line, as is shown in the animal product processing. When one deals with an animal, as you're well aware, there's only so many center cut pork chops, only so many T-bone steaks, and then we have a lot of hamburger meat, and we have a lot of sausage. And it is one of the goals that we have in our laboratory is to help these growers and ranchers to find ways to utilize that material at a higher revenue that leaves more margin with them. Let's talk a little bit about renewable energy specifically. It's a buzzword. This state has taken leadership for many, many years in renewable energy. We called it ethanol back in the early days. Now it's almost anything you can think of. It's all of our commodity groups that range from the biomasses, corn, soybean, wheat, barley. All of these items have an opportunity to generate energy and can be used accordingly. And we can use them in other places after it has generated that energy, because ash may be left and other residuals after processing may be left. And from that standpoint, these may and have been shown to be very interesting soil amendments. Biogases. A lot of people talk about taking stover and doing something with it that allows it to be burnt and to create energy. Can be done. And hopefully we have some projects in play that will show that it's economically feasible and can go forward. Also, keep in mind, too, that if you take something like a biomass of that type, and I use stover strictly as an example, one might find a situation in which you can move that into energy, turn that gas in, it's a syngas, turn it into ethanol or some other fuel-related material. Could be isobutane. Consumer use. I suspect some of you folks perhaps may have some of these stoves that you use biomass pellets. And the best biomass pellet probably is a kernel of corn. So we're operative in that area too, working with folks to move that forward. Co-product utilization, I've kind of touched on a moment ago. Every one of these co-products cannot be just thrown aside and assigned zero value, because there's no such thing as zero value. If it's zero value, you typically have to pay to get rid of it. So therefore, it has a negative impact. So it is our task to move forward in that area. The United States Department of Agriculture has recently released in the bio-based industrial products area some areas that they're going to hold federal offices accountable for. We're going to take a look in this state at all federal offices that may take advantage of bio-based products that are being manufactured in the state of Minnesota and get in that cycle with those folks to move those products forward. Thank you. project examples. Well, biodiesel certainly has been around in our laboratories since 1990. It's been in our state for the last 4 or 5 years, and it's probably in your tank today at some 2% level out there if you drive a diesel fuel. We also don't stop with activities in that area. We're looking at biodiesel to be utilized in very large engines, locomotives, some activities in progress there, and to some of the large tugboats that may be going up and down the Mississippi. Just remember, those boats utilize 1 million gallons of fuel a year. 1 million gallons. One boat. Now, if you're going to go all the way to the top with the big engines, you now think about the smaller ones. It could go in lawnmowers. It could go in Arctic Cat type of things, and I don't mean to call a name there, but various type of recreational vehicles. There will be a product in the marketplace today available probably by early summer that will be using biodiesel in a recreational smaller vehicle. Did you have a question?
Well, you said the tugboats, Mr. Norris, use 1 million gallons each?
A year.
It'd be like my Suburban.
Yeah. That's why I don't have one anymore.
Okay. So. Please continue. That's a lot. That's quite a number.
Yes. The co-products for energy, too. I have given you probably some examples a moment ago. Burning the stover, burning the corn. Now, that doesn't go over too well in a country, even though we're well-fed in this country. There are people that probably don't have enough to eat. The world certainly doesn't have enough to eat. But sometimes in the future, God help us, if we get there, we may have to make decisions of whether we're going to burn it or eat it. Because heat and food really is kind of the same thing. DDGs for flowability. If we're going to move distillers' dry grain with solubles, we will need to move them further than our borders because we certainly cannot dispose of all that we produce in this state. And we're going to have to produce it and move it probably beyond our shores because we may not be able to dispose of it here either. And one of the difficulties that we have and with these materials is that when you put them in large containers and they stand around for a while, they form not small pellets, but several thousand pound pellets. And we have been working with the corn growers, national corn growers, and we've been working with a firm in defining some methodologies that we believe is going to improve those characteristics. Straw-based cardboard. As you're well aware, anything that you buy seems to come in a box of some sort. And we have to do something with it. A lot of it gets recycled. But as I understand, there is not enough cardboard and in the world to keep up with what's going on. So we're going to have to look for other sources to be able to deal with that. And we look at fibers that come from agricultural products. And we have activities going on in the organization that hopefully is going to lead to success in that area. To discount the use of pulp because of the price. Pulp is in short supply and very high price. Wool mulch. I almost chuckle every time I see that. But when it comes down to it, in the combing of wool and so forth, as some of you may be well aware, there is wool that does not have the value. That material, when combined with other biofibers, has the opportunity then to be used with agricultural growing of fruits, vegetables, and things of that nature for weed control. It also has the opportunity to enhance the growth characteristics of the plant. It sets more fruit. And the root system is much, much further into the soil. awful utilization. That's not another word for terrible. But awful, of course, is the stuff that's left over from the insides of an animal, the brains, the things of that nature, and so forth. And
Representative Hamilton, to that point,
I traveled to China, and that's what we ate. And there's a reason they call it awful.
Mr. Norris,
thank you. On that note, I have to compose myself. In the awful area, a terrible word. One of the issues that we have to deal with is that there is a large amount of awful around, but there's not a lot of awful in one place. Does that make any sense to anyone? So typically, if it does, we have undertaken a study and are just about finished with it to define where the awful in the state of Minnesota is, and even to some extent the surrounding states. And then looking at who in our state might be interested in participating in a central location to where all of these materials could be brought to bear there. If you take that material then, I'm not suggesting that we send it to China, although some may be sent there. I would suggest that these are very good ingredients that go into the pet foods to feed the pets that we all love. How many times have you gone into the grocery store and you find sitting out there just maybe 20, 30 feet of pet foods, and they're not cheap either. When it's all said and done, the dog and the cat gets fed better than we probably do ourselves when it gets down to it, because we can feed them a balanced diet. When I sit down and maybe others sit down, we don't always eat a balanced diet, but what's in that can or in that container is balanced. So we have some opportunities here. We have an opportunity to make awful a buzzword in the state of Minnesota. And maybe we'll change that word a little bit as we go forward. But hopefully we'll be able to find a way to remove that stuff short of a landfill. A lot of it does go in landfills. And consequently add value to the producer. The last thing that I want to share with you today is that in 2004, we were informed in late September that we were awarded $1 million from the United States Department of Agriculture Rural Development for their Ag Innovation Center grant. We targeted our center for producer-owned energy. And basically speaking, we did essentially what we said we were going to do. We dealt with producers. We dealt with, from that competitive grant, I'll just skip down because that's where I was going anyhow, to 20 projects that have impacted 43 producers. We'll probably have two new ethanol plants in this state. One in northwestern Minnesota, I can tell you right now, has already raised equity to go forward with the building of a plant. We have another one in northwestern Minnesota that is in the process of finalizing some of their activities moving toward the equity drive. We have worked with biodiesel. We've worked with gasification. Gasification, burn it, form gases, convert it to ethanol. Project very large in the southwestern part of the state that we've had the opportunity to deal with. So any place that you can look that we can take agricultural products, agricultural side streams, and move that forward, we certainly can make those contributions on the ground in the rural parts of our state, because that's basically where we've housed most of these activities. We provide assistance to these producer-driven ag-based renewable energy crop projects across the state. We set today with approximately $750,000 worth of potential projects on the table. I started to say on the books. We can't put them on the books. And this is not a pitch for funding from my point, but we're hoping that back with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, we'll have an opportunity to maybe be able to do something in that area. Because they gave us provided the award to us, we have used it effectively, and we put activities on the ground that has promoted renewable energy. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Norris. Any questions for Mr. Norris or Ms. Spade? Representative Welty?
No question, Mr. Chair, but just a comment. I visited your Waseca location, and I have to say I recognize staff when I came in the room, and you guys are doing a wonderful job at ARI. That's what I call it, A-U-R-I, but it's great to see the projects that you've brought forth. I know there are tremendous ideas out there right now that are kind of being circulated around, and the research is being done, and hopefully some of those will come to fruition and will increase our agriculture sector in Minnesota and the value-added crops and the value-added production of commodities. And so keep up the good work, and hopefully in the future we can continue to support your endeavors and maybe even with additional dollars in the future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Walter. Okay, thank you very much for your presentation. We will now go to the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, I just would like to draw your attention to growing the... Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Growing the bio-business economy in the Northland. AURI is hosting an event in Bemidji on the 28th, and I will be there, as will some of the faculty members that I teach with at Bemidji State University. So if anybody's out there considering coming, the last event they hosted was a real great educational experience for the whole community, and that kind of jump-started a lot of our projects there. So I'm glad you're coming back.
Thank you. Thank you. Look forward to seeing you there.
Thank you, Representative Moe. Okay, Representative Magnus moves to the minutes of April 4th. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Okay, we will let the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council set up here for a second. Members, while they're setting up next Tuesday, we're looking at the survey farm issue. We don't have the bill in the committee, but it'll probably be an amendment on the floor, and I thought the Ag Committee had better be brought up to speed with what some folks are trying to do with that issue. Another issue that could come before us next Tuesday has to do with the University of Minnesota in some licensing within a specific apple farm, and there seems to be some consternation, if you will, within the apple community. There is such a thing. We have in La Crescent, Minnesota, very large, many, many producers of apples, so we're going to be taking a look at that also next Tuesday. So with that, I'll turn it over. If you could, you folks could introduce yourselves and who you represent for the record, please.
Excellent. Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. For the record, my name is Julie Tesh, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council, otherwise known as MAILC. That's what I'll be referring to it from now on, because it's a little long to say otherwise. And we're just going to get booted up here, but I did hand out packets to everybody so you can follow along if you like. Thank you for this opportunity today, Mr. Chairman, for allowing us to present today. A lot of you may be wondering what exactly MAILC is, and MAILC is a 16-member council that was created in 1997. We were created as part of an initiative of the Minnesota Association of Agricultural Educators. And we're comprised of leaders of government, many members in here are actually on our council, government, education, and the private sector. And we're here to strengthen agricultural education at all levels, whether it's ag literacy at the grade school level, secondary education with FFA, 4-H, things like that, or also at the adult farm management level, FBM, things like that. We were specifically created because we have a severe shortage of ag teachers. In 1997, we were finding that we just did not have nearly enough graduates in Minnesota and around Minnesota to fulfill all of our teaching openings. Nothing? All right. Thank you. And not for the record, but this is Ulrika Speckland, and she's our program assistant. We're a two-person team here, so thank you. Obviously, we all know that Minnesota is a leading state in agriculture, yet we are facing a critical shortage of agricultural education teachers and also well-trained workers. And being from a rural area myself and living here in St. Paul, as much as I love it, it would be nice to return to a rural area, but right now that's just not possible. To give you a little background on the mission of MEALC, the mission is to provide leadership to expand and grow agricultural education in Minnesota. Very broad, but that's what we do. We look at agricultural education on all levels. We really view ag ed as a lifelong learning process, learning about where your food comes from and then learning how to be good stewards of the land and also learning how to teach about it as well. Some of our guiding principles are that Minnesota is definitely stronger when people understand the importance of agriculture. It is important for agricultural education to serve both youth and adults. We continue to have a statewide focus, and then also trying to market agricultural education as a great profession. A lot of people don't think of becoming an ag teacher or being a farm business management instructor as a worthwhile job occupation, but it definitely is and is very rewarding. Some of our key objectives to let you know is that is to increase enrollment in our agricultural programs in Minnesota. This is both at the high school level and at the post-secondary level, and I'll be referring to this later on in the presentation, and we have been very successful in these endeavors. We coordinate activities to improve programming through increased partnering of various organizations, and I talked about private and public organizations. We'll go over that a little bit as well. We're increasing the scope of agricultural education geographically and programmatically. Some of you may be aware of the Agricultural and Food Sciences Academy, which was started in Badness Heights, originally in St. Paul. They just built a building. We have 190 students. They're studying agricultural and food sciences. They're coming from St. Paul, Minneapolis, all over the suburban area, and it's been a really great, great endeavor for us, and we invite any of you that would like a tour out there to let me know. And also to strengthen our high school agricultural education programs and FFA chapters. And then we also act as an umbrella organization for agricultural education in Minnesota. We work as a team. We like to call it Team Ag Ed. We work with the University of Minnesota, with MinSCU, with the Minnesota Association of Ag Educators, and the list goes on. I'm not going to go over all of our membership, but we do have a 16-member council. Mr. Chairman, obviously you are the chair of MEALC. We are full on our council, and we are awaiting a representative from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Amy Sobieski was our representative, and since she left, we will be getting a new representative from there. But as you can see, we do have people from all over the state and from all different backgrounds, and it's been very valuable having everyone there. Obviously, funding. Funding is always a fun topic for everybody. This is what our funding looks like for this year and for the past few years. We are in the base level funding of the University of Minnesota, going directly into the College of Agricultural, Food, and Environmental Sciences. You'll see here that MEALC operations receive $177,630, and then our grant, $88,815, and then the Ag Ed Division operations is $222,306. And to explain to you the difference, the Ag Ed Division operations, MEALC is housed at the University of Minnesota on the St. Paul campus, so I am embedded right in with the department. And the Ag Ed operations, that goes to pay for a professor. We have a recruiter specifically going out to high schools recruiting Ag Ed students, and that also pays for a graduate student as well. So that money is separate than what I'm dealing with our grants and scholarship program, but it's all in the same base funding. So our total is $488,000. So it's kind of a nice little complicated thing, but it does work for us. So we have been able to get some new staff on board and to increase our enrollment. Just to go through some of our accomplishments, and there are very many, we do have a wonderful grant program. We've awarded over $900,000 to local schools, many of them in your districts. Our scholarship program, we have awarded $110,000 to recruit and retain students in agricultural education at the University of Minnesota, both the Twin Cities and Crookston campuses, and also at our partner institutions. In the past, we have been working on biotechnology, and we have a biotechnology initiative where we paid for certain teachers to get training in biotechnology to use in their agricultural classrooms. Our Ag Ed network, basically our Ag Ed family, and then our Agricultural and Food Sciences Academy, this was just a pipe dream about 10 years ago, and it's been just wonderful seeing these students that have not a lot of knowledge about agriculture come out and really want to study agriculture and agricultural education. We have a teacher induction program. When I talk about lifelong learning, after a student becomes a teacher, whether it's a pharmacist management or a high school ag teacher, we have a teacher induction program to help them stay in the teaching profession, because those of you that are or were educators know that it's a tough job. And the first 5 years, we have a large fallout rate. And our job with the teacher induction program is to make sure that they're getting their questions answered and that it's welcoming to them and that they want to stay in teaching. We have also had a student internship program for our college students. We do have increased visibility for agricultural education in Minnesota. People still ask, what is Ag Ed, but not nearly as much. And public policy initiatives impacting agricultural education, we work very close with MAAE and Jerry Schoenfeld. And then we've also been utilized as a neutral board to listen to the needs of ag literacy and ag education around the state, because we do have such a wide varying group. Before I go on with more about MEALC, some of you, I think most of you are very knowledgeable about ag education, but I'm just going to give you a little refresher course on agricultural education. Agricultural education is built on three core areas. We like to pride ourselves on being interdisciplinary. And intercurricular, not extracurricular. FFA is not extracurricular. In order to participate in the FFA, you must be in an agricultural education class. So the three parts of agricultural education are our classroom and lab instruction, our supervised ag experiences, and that's where you have your own project, and your teacher comes out and checks your books and makes sure that you're doing everything okay. And then we have the FFA student organization. And you'll see there we have our three areas. Our classroom and lab instruction, obviously that's very self-explanatory, but what we really focus on is learning by doing. Agricultural education is hands-on learning, a lot of hands-on learning dealing with science, math, social studies. I'm the type of person, and I was the type of student, where I learned best by hands-on learning, and agricultural education was definitely a bonus for me. The supervised agricultural experiences puts that information into practice. All students are expected to have an agriculturally related work-based learning experience while enrolled in Ag Ed classes. Now, since we're in the urban areas and suburban areas and the majority of our students are not on farms anymore, we get to have some really neat supervised ag experiences. We have some pet groomers. We have some koi farmers. We have just about anything. And, you know, agriculture is so broad that we can really help a lot of students out. And then, obviously, the FFA. We had our FFA Day at the Capitol last week, and you can tell that they're an integral part of the fabric of our society. And they don't have to participate in FFA, but it is strongly encouraged that they do participate in the FFA. And FFA obviously means career success. And in the FFA, we do tout ourselves that you can prepare students for more than 300 related careers. One of the things when trying to promote agricultural education is that parents and students will often say, I don't want to be a farmer. That's fine. If you want to be a farmer, that's fine, but if you don't, there's 300 plus other careers that you can go into. And obviously we all know the importance of the economy and jobs in our state, so 350,000 jobs in Minnesota relate to agriculture. And this is more than 3M, Target, and Northwest Airlines combined. And the picture in this presentation is of Hannah Vanderhoff, and she's from the Ag and Food Sciences Academy, and there she's receiving the National Champion in Agri-Science. She was the best agri-science person in the entire nation, and that is something that we're really priding ourselves on in Minnesota, is that we do have a strong agri-science reputation. How do students obviously benefit from agricultural education? I hope you will all know the benefits, but obviously this is the mission of the FFA. FFA makes a positive difference in the lives of students by developing their potential for premier leadership, personal growth, and career success through agricultural education. And Representative Hyde Gerken, you're in that picture.
This is from last week.
Which one?
It's a halo above him. He's glowing. What can I say? But obviously, these are the three things that we emphasize in the FFA. And the other things that we really also promote is hands-on learning, like I said before. Agricultural education is multidisciplinary. You're not just learning out of a book and reciting things onto a test. A big thing that we pride ourselves on is sharing agriculture with younger students. If you've ever been to the Minnesota State Fair and have gone to the, we call it the FFA Barnyard, but now it's the Miracle of Birth Center, that is completely run by FFA students. And they do such a good job with our younger students, and I hope you'll come this year to the State Fair because we're tripling the size, and it's going to be quite impressive. And then also, we very much do encourage our agricultural education students to give back to the community. That is something that we really do pride ourselves on. Shifting gears, going from secondary education into post-secondary education, if you remember, MILSI was created because we did have a shortage, and we still do have a shortage of qualified agricultural education teachers in our state. In 1993, we had approximately 32 students in agricultural education at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, and they're going to shut the program down. With a lot of help from the legislature, from MAAE, and many other sources, MILSI was created and money was put into the university to help strengthen this major, and I'm proud to say that we have risen enrollment by 300%. We're at 105 students right now, and we do have one of the highest retention rates in the College of Agricultural, Food, and Environmental Sciences at 86.7%. We do have our department head, Daryl Hartle, here, if you do have any questions for him, but we do view ourselves as a family. Once we get you in the door, we keep you. We really try and work with our students, and we do have two different areas. You can study agricultural education to be a teacher, or you can study agricultural education and go into what Representative Finstead graduated in agricultural leadership training and development, which is helping you deal with human resource development, training, extension, things like that. To give you some statistics about current Minnesota Ag Ed.
There goes the credibility.
Representative Finstead
graduated?
I didn't even aware.
Okay.
I think you graduated.
I'm all grown up.
In agricultural education, like I said before, we do have 105 students enrolled at the University of Minnesota and our partner institutions. And I will show you a map of the state and show you our partner institutions here in a minute. In Maine, we will have 23 students graduating. We're very proud of that. And then we will be having 24 new students and transfer students in September. So we are holding our own. Obviously, we would like that number to be higher, but we're working on it. It comes with time. Now, in secondary high school agricultural education, we have approximately 20,000 students in grades 7 through 12 taking agricultural education courses in Minnesota. Approximately 3,000 of them are in grades 7 through 9. We are really working on trying to get into the middle schools more, but with budget cuts it is difficult, but we really are trying to get in there because it's a good feeder program for our high schools. And our current membership in the FFA is at 8,500, and that has been growing over the last few years. This is our map showing our partner institutions. You obviously can tell where the University of Minnesota is at. And then we do have a program with the University of Minnesota, Crookston. They have a couple options there. They can either study all 4 years in Crookston, and they take a lot of their classes via ITV with the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, or they can take 2 years there and then transfer down to the Twin Cities and take their education courses. You can also start at Central Lakes in Brainerd, Ridgewater College in Wilmer, South Central Tech in Mankato, or at Minnesota West in Worthington, and do your first 2 years there and then transfer to the Twin Cities. So we have a transfer agreement with each one of them, and they are also connected via ITV with the Twin Cities, so they'll take their introductory Ag Ed courses and be on track to graduate in 4 years when they do transfer to the university. And this is a growing enrollment area because a lot of people are wanting to stay in their home areas for a couple extra years. So this is something we're very proud of. Talking about our secondary and our post-secondary programs, our MILSI grant program has been what I think one of the most successful things that we've done. We have awarded over $900,000 since 1997 to local programs. And I'll go over some of the impacts here in a minute. But grants is on to high schools, post-secondary programs, FFA, and community-supported groups. And we also do have an emphasis on securing outside funding. We are not a 501c3 because we do receive all of our funding from the government. But we do try and secure outside funding, and we have had some great donors with Medtronic, Pioneer, Quest, things like that. Our statewide grant impacts, we have awarded 184 competitive grants. Five new programs have been started because of our money. This money was used to purchase basic things like books and curriculum that these schools did not have and could not survive without. 122 grants have gone for curriculum and equipment. We've funded anything from a hydroponic lab to diesel engines to biotechnology equipment and anything in between. 26 grants have been for agricultural literacy, either working with ag in the classroom, working with local farm organizations and buying book bundles. And we have worked quite a bit in the urban and suburban areas with farmers' children's gardens. And 26 grants have been for post-secondary and farm business management programs. And that's something that has been really beneficial. We've been working with mental health, working with leadership, working with a lot of different things with Java charts and the Toolshed website. And then five grants have gone to the FFA, working with students. Just a few statistics here for you, since I know you all love numbers. As of December, we had 119 programs reporting sufficient evidence of impact. One of the things of being director is I get to keep track of all of the data coming back in, and that is something that's very important so I can report back to all of you how your money is being spent. Currently, we have a 65% reporting rate, and it is continuing to go up. But right now, we have 98,197,000 students in Minnesota that have been affected by our grants program, and that is without replication. Most of our grants are replicated, whether or not it's buying equipment or curriculum. That equipment and curriculum is used year after year after year. So I think that's a great number, and that equals out to about a total investment of about $9.40 per student impacted. So some comments that we've gotten from students and teachers that have received grants are that they created a course. The course created was able to integrate science and math concepts while using agriculture as its base component, which is very important to us. Students gained a better understanding of what it means to be a leader in their community, and the access to technology increased the linkages between business and education. In FFA and agricultural education, if you're doing a record book, a lot of these programs don't have their own computers, and the teachers are using their own computers for their kids to use, and so a lot of these schools have been applying for technology to help their students out. And this is a picture of a greenhouse in Forest Lake, which has been very successful. And then also some of our other grants have kept farmers up to date with improving technology in the swine industry. Minority populations were exposed to agriculture and what it has to offer. And our money has also provided needed training to farm business management instructors to become certified rural outreach workers. I could go on and on with the comments, and they are varied, and they are wonderful impacts that people have used this money for all around the state. Our scholarship program, just to briefly touch on, we use this money to both recruit and retain students in agricultural education. We have awarded $110,000 since 2000. And it has helped a lot get students here because it's very tantalizing to sometimes go across the border to River Falls or to South Dakota or somewhere else and study agricultural education. And we try and keep them in the state because we do feel if you're going to be an agricultural education instructor in Minnesota, your best education is going to come from the University of Minnesota. So we try and keep them in the state when at all possible. I mentioned the Agricultural and Food Sciences Academy before briefly. I just wanted to mention it again. It did open in the fall of 2001, and we have 190 students there right now. It is just going strong. I believe we'll be having around 230 students next year. They have capacity for between 250 and 275, and they are a charter school, and they are an exemplary charter school. They are not the ones you see in the papers that have bad headlines. They have good headlines. So keep that in mind. One thing that I mentioned before was also our teacher induction program. We get them excited about ag ed in high school, we get them in some major, and then they graduate and they go to teach, and then they're like, now what do I do? This is really scary.
We have a program working with Dr. Jorger in our Department of Agricultural Education, and it works with teachers in their first through third year, trying to help them and mentor them in being good teachers. We assign them a mentor, and they meet quarterly to discuss their trials and tribulations. And it has helped. Dr. Jorger has the exact numbers that they have used, but it is helping retain our teachers, because agricultural education majors are well-rounded people, and business really likes them. And so they get tantalizing offers to leave quite a bit. Some of our public policy initiatives of MLC, since we are a legislative council, is including agricultural education in science standards. I've been talking a lot about agri-science and talking about science in the context of agriculture. And at this point, I'd like to call, if I may, Mr. Chairman, if I could call forward Jerry Schoenfeld.
Certainly.
Right now, we do have a bill in the Senate that Jerry will discuss, and then also a House file as well.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jerry Schoenfeld. Today, I'm representing the Minnesota Association of Ag Educators. As most of you know, over the years, I've carried a few different hats around here, and one of the hats that I do work with is as executive director and lobbyist for the Minnesota Association of Ag Educators. Before I talk about the bill, I just wanted to say a little bit about MLC itself, because it was started in 1997, and I want to tell you a couple of things about it. First of all, it originally was a bill that was brought forth really a kind of an emergency time for ag education, and the fact that I think in 1997 we had 6 graduates in ag education in Minnesota. Last year I believe there were 27. That's quite an increase in a particular area. The same was true, I think it was mentioned by Julie, that it was down to 30-some people in the program. Now they're, I believe, with all of them close to 120, something to that effect. So it has really made a difference. The reason I point this out is because it's a situation in which this legislature acted at that time to institute something to really bring about a change, and it really worked. And one of the things that I guess that's the point, it really worked. And it wasn't only in that, but it also, as she's pointed out, created the Urban Ag School, the Academy, and a number of other things. It's been a very large success story for ag education in Minnesota. And I don't usually get very enthusiastic about some of these things because I've been here for 25 years, and you know, but this is one that I really do because it's really been a good success story. But it does have problems as well. One of the things that she's probably not, she showed you a little bit about the funding that was there. But one of the things that she didn't mention was that this funding was originally incorporated into the Ag Special in 1997 as part of the University of Minnesota Ag Special. It originally was set at $1 million. A portion of it went to the Department of Ag Education itself in order to hire additional instructor at that time, and the other portion went to MLC, and she showed us in the grant programs and the administration of that has done. But what wasn't said is that there has not been one penny increase since 1997. And when there were decreases that were brought forth by the university, such as the internal revenue sharing program that they had, or when the legislature cut the Ag Special, this program took cuts. It took cuts, but it never got any increases. And I think next year, when the budget comes up, I point this out because I think it's going to have to be something that's looked at. But there's a unique problem here. And that is that this was created by the legislature as a somewhat standalone council, and yet it is attached to the University of Minnesota because that's the only place ag education is granted in this state. And yet it's very difficult for this council to go through the normal process within the university because there is no feeder into it in the normal way for increases in funding. So I point that out to you because it's a unique problem, I think, that is facing this and something we are going to want to take a look at in the coming year. As was pointed out, there are 190 high school programs in ag education in Minnesota. There are about 90 farm business management programs as well. So that I think it's a little more widespread than most people realize. Serves approximately of all the career and technical areas in the state. We have about one-third of the students that are in that are served through this. The other thing I mentioned about the funding is a potential problem for MLC, but for ag education in general, there's another problem. And that is that as legislators over the number of years, everyone wants high academic standards. In order to accomplish that, for those of you, and I see at least one, I guess, a couple here that are on the education committees, you have brought forth higher academic standards, increased numbers of sciences, for instance, increased math in the high schools and so forth. The problem is that as you bring all of those required courses in, it decreases the ability of things like ag education to compete for the time schedule of the day, the number of slots that are left for students to take courses. The electives become fewer and fewer. So in order to deal with part of that, I might point out that ag educators, and I know that Representative Finstead had to go through all of this, and I'm a former ag educator, and I had to go through it at the University of Minnesota, have a very extensive science background. It is as extensive, primarily as extensive as people that are in science areas. Maybe not exactly equivalent, but very extensive in that they take physics and chemistry and biology and botany and zoology and on it goes. And I see Representative Junkie speaking that because he was in that same area. But in addition to all those basic sciences, it also has things like plant pathology and entomology and on I could go about soil science and all kinds of things. Anyway, it's very strong in science. So this year we have brought forth that is already in the Senate bill, and I've talked to some of the members of this committee that serve in the Education Committee. We're going to make an attempt to also find a place for it in the House Education area as well to allow for agri-science courses, if they meet all of the standards that are necessary for science approval at the local curriculum level in the local school, that an agri-science course would be allowed to be counted towards one of the three required science courses that are at the high school level for graduation. In addition to that, we're also looking at the idea of economics. Actually, I took a look at the number of economics courses that are required between social studies programs and business education programs, which currently in law allow for are the places that teach the economics, the half-credit economics that's required in the current graduation standards. Ag education actually has more credits required in their bachelor's degree in economics than does either social studies or business education. So we're also looking at that to allow ag educators to fulfill the economics requirement for graduation as well. So those are the two things that we're taking a look at. And exactly that form, I guess, Representative Johnson, maybe as we go through that whole thing, hopefully can find a place for this kind of effort. I know we've talked. In any case, Mr. Chairman, I just want to say something. That was what I wanted to say about some of the initiatives that we're trying to do for ag education this year in the legislature, and in addition, the fact that kind of some of the holes that we see that maybe next year when the budget year comes up, we're going to have to take a look at again. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Heiger.
Thank you. I think, Representative Maxine, I think you're ahead of me.
Did you have a hand up? Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Heigerken, but that's fine, I can leave behind you too. But my question is, with all the science courses, when I taught, we kind of worked it out with ag at that time in the school I was at, we had an ag program and I'm was in the sciences. But my question is how, we tried to pass a bill on the floor the other day about alternative licensure, which went kind of down the drain, but, how far are you from a license? We need chemistry, physics teachers especially, and then biology. How far away are you? And I guess my question is, why would you that have ag not be able to teach some science? Or else we get a variance and get a real dummy in there. Oh, this is on tape. I keep forgetting.
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Finn, you're asking probably for what needs to be in an education committee for quite some time, but there are two different sides of this thing. One is the requirement, the credit requirements that students must meet in order to graduate from high school. The other is through No Child Left Behind and some of those kinds of issues that you have to be a highly qualified instructor. And so what we're trying to do is, and I know the bill that was on the floor
was to partly address some of that, to expand the ability or flexibility in those areas. But what we're proposing with this agri-science is an ability to fulfill the science. It would still be coded in the Department of Education as an agricultural education course, but it would allow for the fulfillment of that. And because it's coded as an ag education course, the highly qualified teacher is there. Now, in further response to your question, it is true that if you actually take a look at the agricultural education program, that there is a lot of science that is required to be there. And we do have some ag teachers. Matter of fact, the president of my association is licensed in both agricultural education and in science and can teach both. The other thing that I would point out to you is that the University of Minnesota has worked with us since about 1995 or 6, somewhere in there, to develop coursework. And there are three courses, curriculums that were developed by the University of Minnesota that meet two things. One is that, and there are courses in plant science, there are courses in animal science, and then environment and natural resource science. And those three courses meet the standards for graduation in science standards that are necessary for graduation. In addition, they've also been instituted into what's called college in the schools program. And we have 13 instructors, ag instructors, that this year will participate with the university to get the additional training this summer to basically be able to do the college and schools program, which will provide for college credit. And they count as science entrance requirements at the University of Minnesota. The University of Minnesota has a requirement that you have to have three sciences to enter. These courses also count towards those science entrance requirements. And so we're trying to cover some of that area and provide more flexibility and more opportunity for people, particularly in smaller school districts that are pressed to try and find a way to fit all of this together and with their available resources.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you hit the nail on the head when you said qualified, because there is a difference between, or maybe a difference between, qualified and certified. And certification means it all when you're out there trying to get a job. But everybody that's certified is not necessarily qualified. So, I was told once by the union head that he could come in a school and tell within a half hour the good teachers from the bad. Now, I don't believe that he could necessarily, but if that's the case, I'm sick of colleges making us jump through hoops to get people to our students. Now, there are some preliminaries. I don't want sex offenders out there, but and other things. But I'm sorry. 1 year of taking off of a job that pays far more than teaching in the sciences, and I know that for a fact, even in my remote area. But then you're going to take a year off and go back to school just to get certification. Something has to be done here. But we'll wake up when it's over the hill as usual and we don't have anybody. Well, and come to. So I'm glad you're doing something.
Yes, sir. Roll, please, Mr. Schoenfeld.
I just want to say we're trying to take a leadership role in some of these kinds of issues.
Thank you. We're going to go Hager Kanjunki, then we do want to get to the avian flu issue here, Dr. Bill Hartman. So, Representative Heigerkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Julius Cassini again. Thank you for all the good work that you have done, and I appreciate it. I missed the meetings, but the alternative licensure was brought up, and I don't think the issue is dead, and I think that's a first play that we need to have done. The second one is revisiting the standards. Representative Dabney and I have are in the process of crafting a bill that I hope everybody in the Ag Committee will sign on next year. And there's been a movement for the longer school year. And Representative Dimmer had the bill this year. And the funding is not there. We need another $900 million or more than that to do what they want to do. But the little school district of Benson just accomplished something here that's in Representative Aaron Peterson's district. And they've added 15 minutes to the day. You can see a lot of school districts do that. By adding 15 minutes to the day, you can add another hour. Instead of having a 7-period day, you have an 8-period day starting at 8:15. You're done at Well, I've got to figure at 2:30, give them 5 minutes between classes and a half hour, noon hour. With that said, Representative Dabney has got some, the Summit School, Summit Academy in Minneapolis have been there. Some of the things they do in vocational training. I think we could develop a correlation between the inner city and outstate and get vocational funding back next year so that we can get that eighth period going again. With the longer day, we'll get eight periods. I think you're going to expose the students to more vocational classes, to industrial arts classes, to electrical engineering, etc. And I think it's just a win-win situation. But we need to revisit the alternative licensure first. And Representative Dimmer has the bill for, I think, Mr. Schoenfield, this year of talking about the ag component of revisiting that, the science issue that you and I visited over. But it looks very good. I talked to Barbara Sikora, the chair, and she's very receptive to that idea as well. But we got a little game to play, but we're going to need your help next year in the battle when we come for next year's funding year. We need to reinstate the vocational funding that we had a number of years ago.
Mr. Chairman, at that point?
Representative Mall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Representative Heigerkin's point, he'll have a lot of support from the northern legislators on the extension of the school year as long as it doesn't go into the Labor Day start.
Yeah.
We will start later.
Not along the school year.
Yeah.
Now, when we keep the school year the same number of days, we're just going to add 15 minutes to a day so that we have more periods. Therefore, they can take industrial arts. We can expose them to, and where we go. I had a company, Wasp, that almost turned a $35 million Air Force contract down because it couldn't find enough welders. We need to start exposing those students to some skills.
Okay, Representative Junkie, and then we're going to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think another, what I'd like you folks to explore a little bit, kind of on what Representative Pennis said, but a different direction, as we look for teachers, ag teachers, and that's what our crisis was in 97, and we still have a shortage. It is difficult. I look at all the people with ag degrees out there. Most of them are in rural Minnesota, including myself. I have a degree in agronomy and a degree in soil science, yet if I want to get my ag education certificate, I have to go to another year of school. And that means, like Representative Pennis, leaving my rural Minnesota job, finding housing, and going to school down at the university for a year. I would hope we could work out a way that you could use those satellite campuses or other ways to get all the people with the ag degrees, you know, even if they get a certificate so they can come in part-time and teach at our schools. Or, you know, I think there's a lot of holes that can be filled in if we made it more accessible to get that extra year you need for your ag education, and rather than taking off the year and coming to the cities. And that's a problem, because I think there are a lot of people, you know, mid-age like me or others that would love to share some of our talents and skills in the classroom. But again, to take that year off, you know, you could get a teaching certificate probably going to St. Cloud State and commuting, but it's not the ag certificate that you need. And so I'd ask you to explore that. I'm not asking you to comment, but explore that for the future, because I think there's some opportunities there too.
Okay, one more. So, Trem, but then, members, if you would please look at the remaining slides that you have before you. We're going to cut it off here and go to the next group. And I thank you, Julie, for your presentation. Representative Tremba.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I want to congratulate Julie. She does an absolutely fabulous job as the executive director, and she always guides us in the right way. I have a little story. The FFA kids came, and I think most of us spoke to them. And today, township officers came. And one of them was a parent of one of the FFA kids that had come, and she said that her daughter has not stopped talking about it and can't wait to come here and intern. So,
very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we will now go to the avian flu. Thank you, Julie, and thank you, Mr. Schoenfeld. We have Dr. Bill Hartman, Bureau of Animal Health, Kevin Elfring, Minnesota Department of Agriculture, Steve Olson, turkey growers. If you could please join us. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Steve Olson. I'm the Executive Director with the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association and the Broiler and Egg Association of Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee.
Well, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to talk about the avian influenza situation. What we'll do today is try to provide you an update on the high pathogenic avian influenza situation in Asia and Europe, as well as give you information about Minnesota's current and prevention and potential future response efforts. First, I want to give you a brief overview of Minnesota's poultry industry. I realize that most of you are probably familiar with it, but I want to run through it within a 30-second time frame here. Minnesota is a hub for a major poultry-producing region in the United States. Minnesota ranks number one in turkey production. We raise about 46.5 million turkeys each year. We have about 200 growers spread throughout the state of Minnesota. We rank eighth in egg layer production with approximately 10.5 million egg layers. And those layers produce nearly 2.9 billion eggs per year. We are home to Golden Plump, a major regional broiler chicken company. Minnesota raises about 44 million broilers each year. In total direct economic value, Minnesota's poultry industry, poultry production, is nearly $1 billion. And those poultry consume a lot of corn and soybeans. Minnesota turkeys alone support nearly 1,800 corn and soybean farmers across the state. Shifting to avian influenza, I would like to do two things. First of all, give you an update on the some background on the global situation. Again, give you an update on what our current prevention and our future responses will be to avian influenza, and then maybe provide some insight or suggestions on what we see happening down the road. Dr. Hartman with the Minnesota Board of Animal Health and Kevin Elfring with the Department of Agriculture will also provide perspectives on this issue. First of all, we realize that this is a big concern to us, and we're concerned about the potential impact on human health. But we also realize that there's a more immediate impact because this is a current animal health issue, and it could wreak havoc on the poultry industry in Minnesota as well as across the United States. It could have a rippling effect on the other protein sources, the other meat sources, as well as the feed grains that supply feed for those animals. I want to start by pointing out that there are several types of avian influenza, and those types can be categorized as highly pathogenic or low pathogenic. High pathogenic is more severe. The H5N1 strain in Asia and Europe is highly pathogenic. The Asian culture and poultry production system is vastly different from the United States. They raise birds in small flocks that are raised outside and are in close proximity with where people eat and live and sleep. The virus in Asia was allowed to circulate among birds. And when the virus circulates, the disease chain is not broken. The virus becomes more virulent or more severe. And that's what happened in Asia. The virus has not evolved to the point where it can be easily transmitted from human to human. As a matter of fact, according to some research that was released by the University of Wisconsin about a week and a half ago, it shows that when humans are infected, the virus resides so deep in the respiratory system that it is not transmitted by coughs or sneezes, as most viruses are. The research indicated several mutations would have to take place in order for the virus to be easily transmitted from human to human. That being said, we are still concerned about the potential for human health and a pandemic, but it may not be inevitable. Shifting to the animal health side of things, the messages that we've had as an industry and that we want to continue to relay and ask you as you're talking to constituents to help us relay is that this is not a food safety issue. First of all, we do not have the Asian strain in the United States. We do not have it in Minnesota. But even if we did have it here, this is not a consumer or not a food safety issue. And what we've seen in other countries is that when they have had an outbreak of the H5N1 strain, there's been a dramatic drop in the poultry consumption there. And it's based on panic and fear, not on science. There's been research that have proven that this is not a food safety issue. And again, that's the primary message that we're trying to get out. Minnesota has had an active surveillance program for nearly 30 years. It was something that was developed cooperatively with the Minnesota Board of Animal Health, the University of Minnesota, and the poultry industry in the state of Minnesota. Every turkey flock raised and processed in Minnesota, and even if they're raised in Minnesota but processed in Iowa or South Dakota or Wisconsin, those flocks are tested for avian influenza, and it is a reportable disease in Minnesota. On a national level, USDA is in the process of finalizing a national H5, H7 low pathogenic avian influenza program. Minnesota and the U.S. commercial poultry industry systems, again, as I've mentioned, are vastly different from those in Asia. Very few people come in contact with the poultry system, poultry in the commercial systems in the United States. And Minnesota used to be a poster child for avian influenza because we've got such a large brooding ground for wildfowl that when we raised birds outside, we were finding that those birds would land, feed next to the turkeys, and diseases would be transmitted back and forth. Since we've moved production inside into barns, we've greatly decreased the incidence of avian influenza. As a matter of fact, the most recent cases that we've had are not avian influenza. There are actually swine influenza that has been found in turkeys. Another factor that's helped us deal with this in the past, and I think it'll help us in the future, is that we're home to a world-recognized avian influenza expert at the University of Minnesota's College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Dave Halverson. As we look towards the future and what may or may not happen, we see one of the biggest areas of vulnerability is the potential for small flocks or other flocks that are raised outside in live bird markets to be a vehicle for H5N1 to come into this country. And so we're working with the Board of Animal Health and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to develop information to get out to small flocks, to get out to 4-H and FFA members, and to get out to live bird markets. And as a matter of fact, the three agencies, or the agencies and in the industry, have had meetings already and are going to continue meeting to develop strategies that if we should get an introduction, whether it's in the United States or in Minnesota, on how to best deal with avian influenza. With that, I will conclude my remarks and just turn the program over to Kevin.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Elfring?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Kevin Alfred, and I'm the Director of Guarantee Inspection for the Department of Agriculture. Mr. Chairman and members, I think what I really want to point out is this is very much of a collaborative effort. This is something that we've been working with not only recently but for many years. And I think one of the things is we've gone beyond preliminary stages of really getting agencies together that would have any responsibility with avian influenza, including the Board of Animal Health, the Department of Agriculture, working with industry, but also the Department of Health with human health influenza and the Department of Natural Resources and other agencies that would have any stake at all in avian influenza. Some of the things that we're going to be doing is we're going to be looking at doing some increased surveillance of certain areas, especially the live bird markets that we do have in the Twin Cities area, and also looking at some of the non-commercial flocks in the state. We're going to be able to do that because we regulate all the live bird markets because they also slaughter at those facilities, where we're going to be able to get samples and have them analyzed, but only analyzed for the low-path H5H7, which are the viruses that have the potential of turning into high-path avian influenza. We'd also be looking at some of our small slaughter plants where birds would be going for slaughter, where we'd be able to do some additional testing at those sites. One of the things, though, is that surveillance is not always the best method of trying to detect a disease like this. If we find a negative flock today, that means it's negative today. It doesn't mean that it's negative next week. So we really are looking forward to putting some educational efforts in developing training materials and educational materials for non-commercial poultry raisers, some of the people that only will raise 200 or 300 chicks a year for their own consumption. So we'll be able to target some of the feed stores that are where they're buying their day-old chicks from, where they're going to be buying their feed from, talking about some biosecurity issues that they can put in place so that we actually can help prevent the avian influenza from either getting here or spreading to multiple flocks. I think another thing that we really need to educate small producers on is if they do have clinical signs of any type of poultry disease, where the birds are getting sick, if they're layer birds where they're not laying eggs, or if they're having birds that are dying off, they need to be diagnosed with what the disease they actually had, especially if they have die-off. So we're looking at offering them pre-diagnostics to be able to actually determine what disease this would be, and actually, it would be beneficial in many poultry diseases that are easily and rapidly spread. I think education is really the key in all of this, and one of the areas that we're going to concentrate on a lot. I think, again, the consumption patterns here in food products in the United States are much different than in the other countries where we have had human illness cases. For example, in most cases, in some parts of the world, if they have birds die, they're probably still going to consume those. Here in the United States, if we have birds die, they're usually going to be destroyed. We don't consume things like raw duck blood soup. And I think, again, we have a lot of different consumption patterns where this is not as widespread as some people think it is. I think there is a lot of research that's going on and whether or not this could become the next human pandemic, and I think that the answers are not there yet. But at least we're really looking at increasing the things that we'll be able to do and hopefully avert any widespread potential of spreading this disease to multiple flocks.
Questions, just to the shipment of chicks, you know, pretty soon we're going to hear the chicks chirping in the Wilmer Post Office. Do they come from just in-state, or they come from out-of-state or out-of-country, or what's the rules there, and how do you check that stock coming in?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Junkie, if they're coming from out-of-state and they're coming from within the state, all of these hatcheries, though, belong to a program called the National Poultry Improvement Plan, NPIP. And they already have a surveillance program in place for avian influenza. So we really feel that the hatcheries really have a good system in place already. And I'd ask Dr. Hartman if he'd like to add anything to that. They actually regulate and work with the NPIP program as well as we do.
That's good. Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be willing to bet that most of the chickens in Minnesota are in very good hands. But I'm thinking about Easter coming up. With all the people who want to buy those cute little pink chicks and give to their kids, is there any necessity for putting a little tag on those chicks for people to be a little bit more careful than they ordinarily would? I don't think it's a good idea in the first place. But a lot of people do like to hand them out at Easter, and I think we should be extra thoughtful this year.
Those are the
marshmallows. Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, one of the things is actually I belong to a national group that works on mainly with live bird markets and trying to develop some ways of actually identifying chicks. It's not an easy system. Matter of fact, some of the things that they do look at are really not very humane, because if you band the birds when they're real young, you know, the band doesn't expand as the chicken does. Yeah. So there are some tags that have been used in some of the live bird markets out in New Jersey, and that certainly could be a consideration. I agree. It probably isn't the greatest idea to begin to get.
Steve's bird is an ugly chicken.
Thank you. Representative Pennis.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. This is a virus, and I want to know if it passes through the waste into the bird defecation.
Dr. Hartman?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Bill Hartman. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health and the State Veterinarian, and to answer Representative Pennis's question, yes, the virus is shed in the feces of birds.
Okay. Now, unlike the bacterium that we're dealing with TB that's gone in 72 hours one way or another, I assume as a virus, when it's not in the living system, it's dead, so to speak. And so people who want to put turkey manure on their gardens, should they be concerned?
Dr. Hartman?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pennis, there is some concern. The virus can last a period of time in the manure, but we don't have the H5N1 virus in the United States right now. And our history in our turkey flocks is that we have had low pathogenic forms that don't make people sick, don't even in most cases make poultry sick. So the concern would be minimal at this time.
And just one follow-up. Dr. Hartman, so that anthrax we've got up there is in the ground, and we're going to, deal with it.
That's a good question.
And that anthrax is a virus.
I have a question.
I'm right?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pennis, bacteria.
Anthrax, the bacteria that's living in there? Yeah. It's a encapsulated one, then?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Then, anyway, the virus, though, is going to die? Or it can't. I mean, viruses are a whole different ball of wax.
Dr. Harbin?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pennis, generally speaking, viruses are more susceptible to dying in the environment than our bacteria. So most viruses die pretty rapidly once they leave the body.
Yeah, I know, but if they get into something living again, I'm not going to talk about reincarnation, but don't they?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pennis, sure. If the virus finds a host that is susceptible to it, yes, they will cause disease.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Herman, so I'm eating a radish. I got meat out of the garden, forage there, and I wipe it on my pants. I mean, I wipe the dirt on my pants. Okay? I know I'm long gone, but aren't other people in danger?
Dr. Hartman.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Pennis, I think that's why people, and Kevin can maybe address this, people do the usual precautions before you eat or you wash your hands and do those sorts of things so that if you're exposed to that, our world might change if the H5N1 avian influenza virus gets into the United States and starts causing problems in people. But as we stand now, I don't think there's much concern on that one.
Mr. Olson, did you have a comment on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Pennis, one thing to add, I think that we're very fortunate. Another fortunate thing that we have with winter is that it tends to kill those viruses so we don't, we've got that break in there from other locales that may not have that.
Mr. Elfring, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Pennis, I'll just add to that a little bit. One of the reasons why there's such a concern with migratory waterfowl is because they live in a really contaminated environment. And if any of you have geese in your backyard, you know what I mean. That they're exposed to feces all the time, which are fresh. So they're going to live out of the host for a certain period of time, but not very long.
Okay, along the same lines here, before I go to Representative Hamilton, Representative Erdahl, if we had fecal material from a poultry facility like that going through a manure digester, do we know if there would be any effect on virus control by processing that manure?
I can take a stab at it. Well, Mr. Chairman,
I'll let anybody take a stab at it. I'm just pulling this out.
One of the things, and I'll equate it to the same as with cooking food products. Cooking and heating is going to destroy the virus. So I would say that the digester would also have the, and I don't have any scientific data that would show that, but I would imagine that you're going to have certain levels of alkalinity and acidity, and viruses they're actually kind of the almost imperfect parasite, because a lot of times they kill the host and then they kill themselves. So out of a natural host, they're just not going to survive. And the temperature, the differences in the pH in the digester, they're just not going to survive.
Representative Hamilton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And either Mr. Alfrin or Dr. Hartman, hypothetical, in the event that confirmed positive is here in Minnesota, are we fully prepared to notify people, to isolate, to eradicate? Are we fully prepared?
Dr. Hartman.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, maybe I can do my presentation because it really answers that question. If you would you like that?
Fair enough. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'll let Representative Erdahl ask his question here, and then we will go to your presentation. And I want to make sure that Dr. Haggerty, who is here in attendance too, who also wants to address this body too. So,
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The gentleman had one question. Another one came up through the discussion. Would you know, burning turkey litter, the biomass, Hyberman, would that rank, would the, there be any contamination from that?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Erdahl, my assumption would be that if it was burned, that it would destroy the virus.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Also wondering what role the University of Minnesota can play in this. I look at the College of Veterinary Medicine. Are they a role they're playing?
If maybe now would be the best time if we just go right to Dr. Hartman's presentation here. I think that will open up a lot of eyes for many of us here. So if you would proceed, Dr. Hartman, with your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And what I wanted to cover is just what the a group of people, not just the Board of Animal Health, but Minnesota Department of Agriculture, the turkey industry, the poultry industry, and other state agencies have done to prepare. And it isn't just since this H5N1 has been causing problems worldwide, but we've been doing this for, as Steve said, 30 years. Under the direction of the governor's office and the two lead state agencies for pandemic influenza preparations, the Public Safety Department and the Department of Health, we are working closely with poultry industry, with the federal government, and other state agencies to be prepared for this H5N1 virus. But we're also preparing for any highly pathogenic avian influenza. There are other strains of it that can have the same impact on poultry. The disease spreads easily, so that's why we call it highly contagious, and it's also highly pathogenic, so it kills a lot of poultry. So in some of these countries where this H5N1 virus is going through, it's having minimum impact on people, but it's really destroying a lot of birds. So we're very concerned about it. We do not have this disease in the United States currently, highly pathogenic avian influenza, and we've never had it in Minnesota. And that's a testament to what all of these groups working together have done to control this disease in Minnesota. If you have some of these low pathogenic forms of the disease and they're allowed to circulate in poultry over time, they tend to become more highly pathogenic, and we've never had that happen in Minnesota, so that's a good thing. Highly pathogenic avian influenza, whether it be H5N1 or any type of the disease, is reportable to the Board of Animal Health. So any time that somebody had a suspicion of this disease, they would report it to us. We would dispatch immediately a foreign animal disease diagnostician to that farm. So we have people on our staff who are trained specifically to go out to these farms and investigate foreign animal disease suspicious cases. We would take samples from the birds, and those samples would be sent to our National Veterinary Services Lab in Ames, Iowa. We're working on getting to the point where we would have our veterinary diagnostic lab here in Minnesota prepared for this, but they still need to have a BSL-3 area to work in, and they don't have that yet. So when that's completed, we'd have the option of sending samples to the lab here in Minnesota. So those samples would be sent there. If the diagnosis were confirmed, well, first of all, we would immediately quarantine that flock when we went out there so they wouldn't be moving things on and off the farm. We would depopulate the flock and dispose of the poultry. And we've had some early discussions about how we might dispose of the poultry. We're thinking there's several options, but we're thinking that if we had highly pathogenic avian influenza, most of the birds would probably die. So there wouldn't be an issue of euthanizing them. It would be simply disposing of them. And one of the best ways we've found of not spreading virus but containing it to this area would be to compost the turkeys right in the barn. So that would be probably something we'd look at first. We would establish movement control zones, surveillance zones, and epidemiologically linked zones. So if this flock had recently moved some birds off of the premise, we would trace there and establish a zone around there. And then we would start doing survey. There would be some movement controls within these zones, and then we would start doing surveillance of the poultry within those zones. And depending on the extent of the disease problem, we would start mounting activation. So the first thing we would do is activate the Agriculture All Hazards Plan, and that's a plan that we work with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, and we might activate what we call an emergency command center right there in the building. There's a conference room that we would use so that we could coordinate efforts. And then not only would all of the resources of the Board of Animal Health be available, but of the Department of Agriculture would be available as well. We can request an emergency response team from USDA to come here. And we did that with the tuberculosis situation. We had two emergency response teams from USDA rotate into Minnesota to help us with the problem. If it became more of an outbreak where we had a lot of farms involved, then we would activate the State Emergency Operations Center, and really all of the resources of the state government would be available to deal with it. The next step would be if the governor declared an emergency under his authority and under statutes. You remember that you've given the Board of Animal Health extended authority if the governor declares an emergency, mm-hmm. and then we could restrict movement of people, livestock, machinery, and other personal property. So if we had to do that, we could do that. If the disease started to affect people, as it has in some countries, then of course the Minnesota Department of Minnesota Department of Health would become the lead state agency, and we would become a supporting agency. So you see, we could from a very small incident to a larger incident, expand what we would have to do to deal with the situation.
Very good. Representative Hyde-Gerken.
Thank you, Dr. Hartman, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I know this is the problem that we're going to have is distribution. Last week I passed a bill in Health and Human Services that dealt with the flu shots. The problem that we've had in rural Minnesota right now, last year with the flu epidemic that we had, it wasn't that bad, or year before it was worse, we couldn't get vaccines in outstate Minnesota. Right now, you have Cub Foods, among others, that buy the vaccine, they'll buy them up in masses, and they'll give the shots. And we had last year out in Glenwood, my legislative assistant got a shot 1 month before we got our first vaccines out there in Glenwood and in Newton, et cetera. So it becomes a distribution problem that we have no control over, neither does the Department of Public Health. There is a bill coming forth that is initiated by the state of Montana, talking about what happens if the epidemic hits. The migratory birds are here. They're not in New York. But New York's going to be the first ones who can get the shots. So there is a bill going through at the federal level. Now, I carried a bill that will be in the House floor next week. Thomas Shumley's carrying the bill that passed, and the Senate will be in the Senate floor. So we're trying to tie this bill in to the federal bill when it comes that deals with the distribution, because the Department of Public Health does not have control over that. You follow me? So I'm hoping that if you get a chance to look at the bill that did pass, that it would tie in to the federal distribution when it comes here. It pretty much directs Department of Health what to do with the vaccines. They cannot, the bill as I've got it written, they cannot do any vaccinations in Minneapolis, St. Paul, until November 1st if we don't have the vaccines announced in Minnesota, which would take care of the epidemic if it did hit. But anyways, so next week when we hear the bill in the House floor, appreciate your support.
Okay, well, thank you, Representative Hyde-Gerken, for that. It's like a great public service announcement here for everybody. Appreciate that. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this may be a question for yourself or Mr. Olson. You know, in the event, again, hypothetically speaking, hopefully we'll never have to go down this path, but in the event it happens, it's going to be devastating to the producers. No question about that. And if the state comes in and we need to take care of those entire herds, are there any safety nets, any security, financial safety nets in place for those producers in the event something like this would happen?
Mr. Olson or Mr. Elfring or Mr. Hartman, any comments?
I can start out. And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Hamilton, First of all, they're flocks and not swine herds. But we're talking about the original white meat here. So. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Part of the National H5-H7 Low Pathogenic Avian Influenza Program, it's been in the process of development for 3 years. It's been hung up in the rule process, and the hang-up has been that we would like to see, as an industry, we would like to see 100% indemnity in the case of that a flock is put down. If it's high pathogenic, then there is, the indemnity is in there. But if it's low pathogenic, H5-H7, and again, those are the kinds that can mutate into a high pathogenic. We want the indemnity right now. They're kind of fighting over it. I think that it's going to go through with 100% indemnity, but until the ink is dry, we don't know for sure. So.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Representative Junkie.
Thank you. Just to the members, a heads up. We're still working on, and Hamilton brought it up earlier, and he was right, what's our plan? And the key to this whole thing is identifying and isolating as rapidly as possible.
Yeah.
And to ID that virus, that means that our poultry testing lab facilities at the U of M and at the U of M facility in Wilmer, actually, is as efficient for movement and equipment and up to date. And working with Dr. Hartman and Bruce Clavin over there, they're going to be talking to Dorman. We do believe we need about $300,000 to upgrade that to make sure it's at peak efficiency to get the early ID and hopefully the early isolation. And we want to make sure we do everything possible. So I gave a presentation to the buying committee. We've been late on it. I introduced the bill last week on Thursday, so it goes through the official process. But I'm going to ask for your support if and when we have to amend that on the House floor. They may do it in Ways and Means. If Clavin and Hartman can get to them before Monday, they could put it on there. But it's not in the Senate bill. And it's at U of M testing facility, which tests samples from all over Minnesota. It's not, you know, just for a certain area. So I just want to give a heads up. And Dr. Hartman, I know, is working on that. He called me a week ago, and we've been working with the industry and other folks to make sure we're there. And maybe you want to comment to the committee, too, Dr. Hartman.
Dr. Hartman, any comments on that?
Mr. Chairman, yes. That laboratory is the Minnesota Poultry Testing Laboratory. And the surveillance that Steve talked about, that's where all the surveillance for the commercial poultry takes place. It's very important that we support that. As Kevin mentioned, we're going to be enhancing the surveillance, and our concern is with that load of increased samples coming in that we need to be ready for it.
Okay. I've got a quick comment here, and then I'll go to Representative Erdahl. I was just reading here, I believe, either yesterday or the day before, about a similar virus to the bird virus that may be affecting the swine industry. Do you know anything about that, Dr. Hartman? Or
Mr. Chairman, but influenza viruses are pretty much in all species, and the swine do get influenza viruses, and they sometimes share them with poultry. So oftentimes this routine surveillance we're doing in the turkeys, we will show up viruses that we believe are swine strains and that have moved over into a poultry barn. So there's the usual situation is there will be a barn full of hogs and it will be not too far away from a barn full of turkeys and they'll get exposed to it. Now, oftentimes those viruses don't cause much disease in either the swine or in the turkeys, but they're influenza viruses.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Representative Erdahl, then Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Junkie was hitting on the role of the university in Wilmer, and I guess continuing with the question I started earlier, what is the role of the University of Minnesota in this, and specifically the College of Veterinary Medicine?
Dr. Hartman?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Erdahl, and I think there are others here who can help answer the question, but they've been very involved right from really the beginning of surveillance for this disease. Once we started raising a lot of turkeys in Minnesota, the University of Minnesota and the College of Veterinary Medicine. And Steve mentioned Dave Helverson's name, and before that, Ben Pomeroy, were very involved in setting up this surveillance system for poultry. So it's really been a cooperative effort between the Board of Animal Health, the University of Minnesota, and the poultry industry that's provided for us to control this disease over time. So they're very involved. They are involved now. We've been working with them very closely on communications to make sure if we get this H5N1 virus that we reassure people that that doesn't mean we're all going to die.
Thank you.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for any of the testifiers that want to answer the question. Just kind of going off of what Representative Junkie was getting to, I just want to follow up and go even one step further, and that is, although we may find the virus, we may isolate it, I'm going to go before that, and have we done the education necessary so that we have the information out to all of the producers in the state of Minnesota so they know, first of all, I'm sure most of them probably know the signs and symptoms, but do they have the information out there about signs and symptoms? And then also to follow up on that, do they know what to expect as soon as, if this were to come about at their location? Do they know what the steps are going to be? Do they know who to contact? Has that information been out there so all the producers are educated?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Welty, I think that's one of the challenges that we have is that these viruses, it's a very complicated issue. And I think one of the things that we have to be able to do is develop good risk communications. Because I don't think that the general public realizes that if we would have an avian influenza case that we do have already, that that's not the one that's going to be the same strain that's in Southeast Asia. One of the things that kind of ties into one of Representative Erdahl's questions is we've been working with the university and the Center for Animal Health and Food Safety and Vet Medicine just trying to put some talking points together that we can get information out. The commercial industry, definitely. They've been working on this, and they certainly, they know the science. But I don't know if we're prepared right now on how we would deal with the public at this point. And I think those are some of the things that we're in the process of developing, these educational materials. And, you know, one of the things when we're going to start this additional surveillance of live bird markets and non-commercial poultry, we want to tell the public what we're going to be doing and what we expect to find. And maybe we will find an H5 or an H7. Which is not high path that could possibly mutate to a high path. We want to desensitize this issue before it becomes a really big issue. And I think the same case goes with BSE right now, with mad cow disease. It's been in the press a few times, and now nobody really seems to be that excited about it. And I think we need to get this to that same point where we don't have the sensationalism.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And okay, so I figured the commercial producers probably knew about this and were very aware of it, but how about our small producers? And I think that it kind of goes back to your issue about the public and education and making sure that our message is out there early that, you know, we have it under control. Hopefully we will have it under control. So my question goes all the way back to then, can you guarantee me today that our small producers and our large producers have been educated on this issue and that they would be aware of how to address the public if this were to arise?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Welty, on the commercial industry, definitely, but no. On the non-commercial and the small flock owners, that education has not gone out to them, and that's what we're in the process of developing right now. You know, I think one of the things that we have to look at is you know, people always think of the traditional ways of raising poultry. It's great to be seeing chickens walking around outside. Well, from a standpoint of this disease and controlling it, that's the worst thing that you can have. We want to try to limit that interaction with migratory waterfowl, and that's the education that we need to get out. There has been some things developed by the federal government, and of course this pamphlet that was handed out today, the biosecurity for the birds. So there have been some materials that have been developed, but it's just a matter of getting that out to the right locations. And, you know, education materials are always difficult to try to develop that's going to be the most effective.
Very good. Members and staff, before we wrap up here yet today, I want to bring down
Dr. Tom Hagerty, who'd like to share with us some comments. Dr. Hagerty, it's a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Tom Hagerty. I am representing today the 2000 member Minnesota Veterinary Medical Association. The membership of the Veterinary Medical Association strongly supports and encourages the Department of Ag, the Board of Animal Health, and the University of Minnesota to upgrade quickly the diagnostic capabilities. As Representative Junkie said earlier, being able to diagnose this in these birds is going to be very important. And if we start getting a die-off, there'll be an awful lot of birds to be examined. We're anxious that the university gets the BL3 laboratory up and running at the Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory. They've promised that they will fund that and that they will get that going. I talked to their lobbyist today and asked them where that's at. I know that going to the university, things move rather slowly, but it's very anxious that this be up and running. And the other is the Wilmer Poultry Testing Laboratory, that it be upgraded so that it can handle more and more of the serum samples. That laboratory gets all of the blood. It runs thousands and thousands and thousands of blood samples every year, and that certainly will be upgraded. But again, the Veterinary Association is very anxious that this diagnostic capability come about. The veterinarians of the state, the practitioners, are going to be some of the folks that are going to see the first birds that get sick. The commercial birds are all undercover, and they're being looked at very carefully. But the question came, what about the backyard fox? What about the pet birds? A lot of veterinarians are involved only in cat and dog work, but many of those people have pet birds and will get questions. And as Dr. Hartman pointed out, the veterinarians are instructed that if they see a disease that looks like H5N1, that is to be reported to the Board of Animal Health, and they send out their foreign animal disease diagnostician. With that, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for having me.
Fantastic to have you here, Dr. Hagerty. Any questions, members, for Dr. Hagerty? Okay, thank you again, Dr. Hagerty. I also want to say thank you to Dr. Hartman, Mr. Elfring, and Mr. Olson for their testimony here today, too. Other than that, other questions? Representative Heidgerken.
Yeah, just talk to Dr. Hartman again, and then I don't know if anybody, if you understood before what I was saying, it's a distribution problem. Right now, if the flu epidemic hits and the avian flu hits in Wilmer, Cub Food could come in and buy up all of the vaccines. They could stock out the regional centers and have Minneapolis and St. Paul would have the vaccines. We wouldn't have any. And it is a problem. So there is a bill. The bill that I have addresses the federal bill that's coming across that they will tie together, and it will not become a distribution problem. We will be the first ones to get the vaccines. That's where the problem is. So that said, thank you.
Okay, I see Mr. Hartman step back to the podium, and I assume you want to comment on that.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Heigerkin, and I think I do understand what you're saying. As a matter of fact, we've had preliminary discussions with the Department of Health and others. If we have avian influenza, high pathogenic, and it's an H5N1 strain, and there's a concern with the health of the poultry workers on these farms, we want to make sure that they're in line to be some of the first people who get vaccinated and who have personal protective equipment so they can work in these facilities. So I think that's an excellent idea.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, with that, members, I'll just say good government most of the time, and we're adjourned.